Hi, everybody. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different and bring on a guest. Today's guest is Sanford Shapiro. Sanford was an educational consultant and learning disability specialist, and he also founded the Bend Learning Center in the summer of 2005. His mission was to bring high-quality educational and family services to Central Oregon for children and adults with learning differences. From a career built as a teacher, teacher trainer, and independent school director, Sanford understood that children and adults with learning differences needed both exceptional teaching and personal mentorship built on evidence, research, and relational excellence. And he is also a learning specialist and executive consultant for Evoke Therapy Programs. And for me, most importantly, he's my friend. Welcome, Sanford Shapiro, to the podcast.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Well, first and foremost, I want to ask you about your background, about kind of what brings you into this work, this combination, bringing cognitive science to the world of therapy. What kind of led to you and to your interest into this field?
Yeah, thanks. That's always a good place to start, isn't it? You know, for me, I really think about that question in terms of, you know, the professional part of me and all my experiences, which I'm happy and love to talk about, that led me to that. And then, of course, there's usually, and in my case, for sure, there's, you know, personal things, you know, in family life and then even in my family of origin that that led me to, you know, really care about bridging the gap between things that we think of as cognitive or learning sciences and the world of emotional health and mental health struggles. So we can, you know, we can go into any or all of those. You know, another thing I would say that's important for me is, you know, bringing it into the present. There's so much talk, good talk about trauma, for example, that's really taken hold in our professional community. That's really good. And there's also been a lot of talk about learning disabilities over the years in the fields of mental health. And I've always been the kind of person that really pays attention to current research and digs deep into the science. But I also have, you know, healthily or not, an aversion to buzzwords. And so I think it's really important to kind of try to tease apart the things that people are talking about. And in reference to trauma, you know, which is another way of saying wounding,
right?
You know, which are, you know, or the idea that that the brain is plastic. These are important things to really wrestle with, but they're not new. So a couple things, you know, in terms of trauma, when people used to think about trauma, in, at least from my perspective, people were talking about severe trauma, PTSD, right, for example, disaster situations. But those are, you know, of course, critical. And, you know, we have endless wars so we have plenty of veterans that are dealing with significant issues like this. But when I bring it down to the world of wilderness treatment, for example, for teenagers, young adults, you know, we're generally not talking about those people. So one of the things that matters to me is to help kind of spread the awareness that one of the most common little T traumas, maybe sometimes morphing into significant wounding, are all of the kids, all of the students that struggle for one reason or another with school. And right, most of that has to do with learning disabilities. And so to kind of wrestle with what's the trauma involved in that and what can we do about it?
You know, I think a lot of parents would be happy to hear that, because when we talk to them about trauma in therapy, they have a hard time identifying the trauma in their family life. And they ask questions about places like school and the peers where this kind of thing happens. So yeah, tell us a little bit about your background. I think people are always interested to hear that about whatever it is from your family of origin or from your previous life, if you will, that got you interested in this work.
Yeah, I think I'll start professionally, a little bit less complicated. But mm-hmm. you know, professionally, I remember, I had graduated as an undergrad with degrees in learning disabilities and psychology, and took my first real professional position as a team member at a residential treatment center in Melbourne, Australia. It was a great and exciting time for me, but I remember the first day of work, I had a little bit of initiation by fire, and there was a middle school girl who I was supposed to just be observing, but there was a middle mm-hmm. school girl who came running down the hall of the school building in this treatment center, and she started going out the window, jump out the window, and there was no other staff around, and so I went into reactive mode, which served a purpose, which was to keep her from going out the window. But I was suddenly on my first day of work as a wide-eyed, in some ways largely uneducated, even in spite of all my degrees. So I was wrestling with this 13, 14-year-old girl. She was screaming and swearing at me, and I kept trying to make deals with her to stop this. Long story short, eventually, you know, she calmed down, you know, and I continued my work, and I was a classroom teacher mm-hmm. with a group of two guys who were pretty much veterans. They turned out to be watching me down the hall, not offering any help, so that was part of my ordeal by fire. But what mm-hmm. I found, Brad, was in this group, in this treatment center, as I began to dig in, it was so obvious that many of these kids, if not most of these kids, who were there for dysregulated behavior, for features of autism, for anger, school refusal, most of them had diagnosable learning disabilities. Mm. And so the behaviors were being focused on without really digging into the cause. But that was really a difficult first job to have. So I spent the next several years really going back and forth because I was a little bit, I had it in mind that I didn't really want to work with these aggressive teenagers. I wanted to get back to the safety, what I thought was the safety of just dealing clinically and cognitively with, you know, more of the learning disability area where the behaviors were more easy. But I found that attempt never worked for me. And I kept going back and forth between working in mental health facilities and working in school scenarios. And finally, you know, what was kind of a pivotal point for me was I met a man in Carmel, California, who wanted to start a school just for dyslexics.
Right.
And he helped train me in something called Orton-Gillingham, which is kind of the gold standard for teaching literacy skills for bright kids who struggle with literacy. And I got really good at that. And I was always able to connect with kids fairly well. But I finally found a skill-based something that helped me actually make an impact, a demonstrable impact on the lives of kids. Somewhere along this line, it began to dawn upon me, though, that there was the world of mental health and treatment centers who were dealing with the consequences and behaviors of school struggles, for example, and the shame-based stuff that we were talking about earlier. There were the mental health facilities who are dealing with mental health. And then there were the learning disability or creative educational environments that were trying to deal with that aspect of things, of academics. And they each had a kind of limited view of things. The LD world mm-hmm. felt like if you could just remediate the learning differences, all the self-esteem issues would go away. And right. mental health treatment centers, back in the day anyways, had the opposite perspective, which was that, yeah, learning differences might be real, but really once you deal with family of origin stuff and family dynamics, that the impediments to learning would go away.
Right.
It just always made sense to me that the bridging of those two things was the real answer. This morning I was thinking, I've always thought in terms of a two-sided coin, but this morning it occurred to me that that in some ways the essence of our work together now, my consulting with Evoke with training, is a three-headed, is an example of the three sides of a coin, you know, meaning that on one side of a coin, there is kind of the deficit model. On the other side of the coin, there's looking at learning differences and seeing how to capitalize on possible strengths. But then there's a third side of the coin, which is if you put those two things together, maybe there are lessons. Maybe there are lessons in the cognitive sciences and looking at deficits that actually can help everybody.
Let's talk about that. I want to talk about that science you've been sharing, but before we get into that, let's talk about the nature of your work at Evoke. Tell us a little bit about that, about the idea, about the collaboration between a wilderness, a therapeutic wilderness program and your work in the cognitive sciences.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I, 2.5 years ago, I, along with my wife, decided to make a radical life move, and we moved to Cuenca, Ecuador, where we're currently spending most of our time. And in the process of doing that, I sold a private practice, which was the Bend Learning Center, which was and still is a day clinic for kids with learning differences. And I also had had over the years a small but important practice in educational consulting, where I did testing. I also did some placement work. And so over the years, I saw that outdoor behavioral health or wilderness therapy works. I had a lot of clients whose families and lives were changed, and had kids and families enrolled in Evoke and other programs. And what's evolved from there is that I've given up that placement part of my consulting practice and have also given up the clinic. And it's left me, people ask me, are you retiring? And I always answered no, but I didn't really know what that meant, frankly. Mm-hmm. Now I've kind of figured out that by giving up placement work and giving up my day-to-day clinic, I'm free to really focus on the things that matter to me most. And what matters to me most, one of the things that matters to me most is to play a part, hopefully an important part, in bridging the gap between mental health and the cognitive sciences of learning disabilities, of attention, of executive functions and memory. I should say that at some point in my life, I married a woman who had two sons, and one of them is the poster child for how struggles with school because of learning disabilities and attention problems significantly contributed to his descent into addiction and depression and anxiety. So the focus of our work together, my work with Evoke, is to bridge those gaps between cognitive science and mental health, and to help train faculty beyond mere words. How do learning differences impact self-esteem? Because that's really been where the focus has already been, you know, for good measure. Not only that, but to really grapple with how do our own learning profiles impact how we communicate? In other words, how can we help clinicians be even better clinicians based on their understanding not only of the how their students think and in practical ways, but also what their learning biases are? Because all learning profiles, how we think, how we remember, how we process language, how we deal with imagery, our ability to remember stuff, executive functions, all those things that we all have that I call a learning profile, which is different than a learning style, which we can get into later. All of us have one of those learning profiles. And in addition to many other things like family of origin, those learning profiles, consciously or unconsciously, impact how we communicate. And all clinicians have that. And so, you know, our focus is to help, part of it is to help evokes clinicians better understand their own learning profiles so they could see their blind spot and their biases and to begin to think out of the box of new ways to reach your clients.
It excites me, reminds me of our early discussions because it parallels the work that we do with parents. You know, this idea that if a parent will look at themselves, will look at the way that they think mm-hmm. and process information and deal with emotions and their unfinished business and how that impacts parenting. And I love it because we talk about that with our therapists in a more emotional level. So for you to bring the cognitive piece is a real blessing to us. You've talked to me about this idea as you've come on board of universal design, which frankly I had never heard of, which might be strange to you, but I'd never learned about this. So tell us a little bit about universal design for learning in therapy, what it means and what it's about.
The universal design for learning came from universal design from product design, which the best way to describe it is from product design is to create a product, and in our case, a curriculum or an approach to learning, but to create a product that will benefit people in special populations, but also benefit the greater good. So the first and most popular example of that is the sidewalk ramp. Mm-hmm. And the sidewalk ramp was created, or not even just the sidewalk ramp, but ramps going up into buildings, including school buildings. And they provide access for wheelchairs, for example. But it turns mm-hmm. out that when steps are snowy and icy, if you clear the ramp for the wheelchair and put a little gravel down, that it would help everybody get into the building more easily. Or in the case mm-hmm. of the sidewalk ramp, it's also good for kids on skateboard. Not that we want them skateboarding on the sidewalk, but that's another mm-hmm. story, right? It also helps parents with strollers, helps people with temporary sprains. There are doorknobs that we've taken a look at that help not only people with cerebral palsy, but also people with a cup of coffee and a bag of groceries in their hands. So that's universal design in a product point of view. And then out of that grew the idea that maybe we could learn to design curriculum that instead of just focusing on, for example, the best way to teach a child who struggles with reading, the best way to teach a specific population with a disability of some kind, that maybe there are lessons to be learned from that special population that we could translate into curriculum design and delivery for everyone. So, for example, an idea that comes to mind is when we are working with kids or teenagers with executive function weaknesses, which has to do with paying attention, for example, and being able to remember sequences of ideas, short-term or working mm-hmm. memory, right? So mm-hmm. when we do that, when we focus on that special and in some ways of thinking disability, you know, segment, you know, we realize that there are things that are really helpful for them that mitigate the effects of working memory issues. So, for example, keeping visuals in mind, having signs that remind. We all in our daily lives use visual signs or artifacts to help us remind ourselves of things that are important to us. People have crosses on their necks. Jewish people have mezuzahs on their doors. People have inspirational things on their walls and their offices. And these are all meant to stimulate values and goals that we have. And it turns out that two things. One is that's really helpful for people with weak memory systems, but it's also good for all of us. Mm-hmm. And it's also a lot, so when we just think, you know, it's really, you call me a cognitive scientist, and I guess that's true because I've studied science and I'm studied the cognitive realm, which curiously includes things like philosophy, not just mm-hmm. the hard sciences. But you know, these are all things that, though we can study them in science, they're also quite simple, right? I mean, the elements of universal design is to think about how do we design and deliver curriculum that will give the most availability and the ease of understanding to the widest range of abilities, whether or not you have learning differences. And then it doesn't become, last thing is, when teachers and clinicians, for example, are given one more thing to do about dealing with a special population, unfortunately, that often turns into being viewed as a chore. When you enliven that with the perspective that this is good for everybody, it's even good for me as a clinician. I can get more stuff done if I understand the impediments and the things that I can do to help myself. It becomes much less of a chore. And I've seen this already with training with some of your folks, is they're getting excited. They want more.
I love the idea that you presented to me when we first started talking about this shift from creating a more narrow niche, which I think has been some of the energy mm-hmm. in this field for some time, is finding smaller and smaller niches to reach people, to this idea of casting a wider net. Can you say to me a little bit about when we first began to talk about this, about a shift that you saw that was needed in the therapeutic industry around this idea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, also professionally, I've been in leadership positions as, for example, an academic director at a therapeutic boarding school. And I've been in and around the treatment world enough to know that couple things. One is buzzwords capture attention, but they don't always lead to effective treatment. So there's kind of two sides to this, you know, and I think it's important to remember that there can be more than one true thing about a particular subject, you know, meaning in terms of learning disabilities. I spent so much of my life, my professional life, trying to get better at helping kids, teenagers, and adults with learning differences and learning disabilities mm-hmm. to get better in their lives, to have an easier life, you know, through education. But it begins to dawn upon you drip by drip. Slowly, you start to realize that I'm learning things and we are learning things. While we look at that special population, we're learning things that are actually helpful for everyone. You know, out of the LD world, for example, when people have really studied anxiety, or when people have really studied depression, they started to learn things about mental health, even though they were studying mental illness, arguably. They started to learn about things like compassion and gratitude. And they started to learn not only about negative self-talk, but about positive self-talk. And so the same thing is true in the field of learning disabilities. When we study how to make people less traumatized by their learning disabilities, you know, so for example, when we study memory problems, we start to learn tricks, if you want to call them that, or strategies, how we all can remember better. And, you know, we all have issues, whether or not we have learning disabilities. So it begins to dawn upon you that we can do two things at once. And that's really the goal of, I think, our work at Evoke, is to get better at working with really vulnerable kids who really, you know, may have 12th grade comprehension, but are reading at a fifth grade level. And so we can start to really open up our minds to even things like when we give them books like Man's Search for Meaning, which has such great messages. But if their reading speed is at a fifth grade level, then maybe there is some digital books that we can use, you know, where they can listen while they read so they can get through it, so that their disability isn't creating unnecessary hardships for them to get the really important messages that are helpful in their life and in their treatment. So there are things that we can do to get really better at helping them. But then it starts to drip by drip, realize that we can cast a wider net, meaning there are things that, you know, maybe there are times when digital books or you know, one of your lead clinicians, you know, recently told me a story of, you know, as a result of the training that we've begun, where I talked about alternatives to writing, or at least not alternatives, but additions to writing. So this clinician was running into a student who was really resistant to writing letters home, one of the right. most important parts of wilderness treatment or any treatment. And as a result of the training, it just, as he called it, it dislodged some of his older thinking. And he gave this kid, who turned out to have a very high intellect, but a very low processing speed, so writing speed was probably going to be impacted. It probably made sense as to why he was resistant to writing. But anyways, this clinician gave him the sort of out, in a sense, or really the alternative, to do a video letter and speaking letter to his parents. And just giving him that alternative opened the door. And this, right. this kid just really started to uncork some emotions, not only wrote that letter or dictated that letter, but then also not only continued to do video letters, but then began to do writing letters, actual writing letters. Yeah. And I think two things were happening. You know, one is he was given a reasonable accommodation, if you want to think of it that way, but also he was freed because he wasn't cornered, because as uh-huh. we know, anybody who has small trauma or wounding or whatnot, whether it's due to learning difficulties or not, when they're, you know, when they're cornered, they don't react well. So giving him an alternative turned out to be really instructive for all of us. And we were reminded of something important, which was the goal is communication. The tool is writing.
Right.
And so casting a wider net, just to tie it all together, is maybe there are ways to think about, without getting rid of the idea that struggle is good. So it's not like we want to take away the struggle of writing, but maybe mm-hmm. there are things that we can do from that special population, so to speak, that are useful for everybody. And we don't necessarily have to have all the answers right now. The beautiful stuff will come not from my expertise, but from, you know, me, as you said, I think earlier, is uncorking everybody else's, you know, wisdom and masterpiece within them, you know, so that clinicians come up with some creative ideas. My job, I think, is to help them rethink how to think about thinking.
It almost brings a tear to my eye when I think about the difference that could make in that young person's life. That, mm-hmm. you know, it's my language, that they were seen mm-hmm. and that the therapist was able to be flexible enough to meet the child where they were at, instead of what I think we do as adults a lot of the time. I know we do it as parents, yeah. as we ask or expect the child to meet us where we're at. So mm-hmm. I want to thank you for that. That's a really special story. And with that, I wanted to ask this idea. We hadn't talked about this. So But I wanted to ask you about the idea of, or your experience of the training. You've had a few trainings at Evoc. Mm-hmm. Of course, you've had field visits in your career at Evoc and other wilderness therapy programs. Any other moments that have come up to you as you've engaged in this project, this collaboration, that have struck you, either whether it be a field staff, a therapist like this, or even one of the clients or students that you've met and heard from?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I was going in the same direction in my mind. I'll start with a quick story of when I had the day clinic in Bend, Oregon. I often worked with individuals, but at this time I was working with maybe six early high school, late middle school boys and girls, mostly boys. And the benefit that they derived from being seen, because A, you know, they clearly knew that I saw them, but being in with other kids who, as one boy said, you know, it just feels so good to, because as they talked to each other, they began to see that, you know, one was an amazing sculptor, one worked with wire, one was an amazing hunter and fisherman, you know, one was a photographer. They had all these strengths and they expressed themselves so beautifully. And one of them said, it's just so great to be around other kids who obviously are really smart, but sometimes forget how to spell the word were. And that really made an impact on me as well. And I'll fast forward to, there was a time I was out in the field in a wilderness group. And we do in our intro circle as adults, you know, in those settings are asked to do is give an introduction, as do all the kids, give an introduction to who you are and why you're there and maybe your age. And so I was participating in that. And of course, in my intro description, I expressed something about my connection to learning differences and mental health. And I may or may not have used the word dyslexia in that intro. And, you know, as I'm interacting with the kids in the intro circle and afterwards, I'm scanning and I noticed that there was this one particular boy who seemed to really catch a lot of attention, or he brought a lot of attention to what I was saying. And it seemed like his eyes were a little bit watery. And afterwards, he came up to me individually and he said a couple things to me. And one of them was, again, with tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, Sanford, I want to know, like, you know, are there schools that can, programs that can help me with not only my emotional issues, but also my learning issues? And, you know, I reassured him that certainly there were. And, you know, I had, after that contact, I knew his educational consultant and contacted his ed consultant. But also, maybe more pointedly, what he shared with me was this. He said, Sanford, when I'm asked in wilderness to write a two-page this or that journal entry or writing response to one of my issues or not, I'm asked to write two pages. And they don't understand, he said to me. They don't understand, they meaning the clinicians and the field staff. They don't understand that two pages for me is like 10 pages for a lot of other people. And so when I come to them with three quarters of a page or half a page, and I've really worked hard at it, but it's just not a natural thing for me writing, they see it. So already I'm hearing the separation rather than the connection, but they see it as withholding or dishonest or lazy, the same crap that happened to me in school. They don't understand. And frankly, he felt like his parent visit was somehow contingent upon the quality of his writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what people don't understand is that there are lots of bright kids. People think of dyslexia, for example, as a reading difficulty, but it's often combined with an interrupt in the writing process. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was, I'm also, you know, I've been around the block a lot. So I usually know when I'm being manipulated. That wasn't the case in this kid's, you know, story to me. And what it led to was a real teachable moment. It had, even just the mention of the word dyslexia, helped this kid not only, as you say, be seen, but it allowed him to express some frustrations, exaggerated or not, realistic or not. He expressed feelings that his clinician was able to capitalize, and it progressed his growth, you know, significantly, you know, in that moment. And it was a small thing at the time, but it was a big thing nonetheless.
It's powerful. I even saw some of the staff and some of the trainings that you've done connect to your message and talk about it at a really personal level for them, the difference that you were making in their lives. And I know for me, probably the most unpleasant part of you and your work with us has been the awareness that I've done just what you described. I have assumed that children who have, I think, have some struggles with learning were just resistant. And so that's been one of the most difficult but important things that you've helped me to realize and to look at in myself.
Thank you.
Sanford, I'd like to read a few facts that you've shared with our team and if there's any thoughts you have about them, but I think it's great for the listeners to hear some of these facts. So there are a few of them here. Girls with ADHD were 3.6 times more likely to meet criteria for an eating disorder throughout the follow-up period compared to control females in one study. The presence of a learning disability among clinically depressed hospitalized children was 7 times higher than in the general population. 35% of children with learning disabilities drop out of high school. It's powerful. 40 to 60% of adolescents in treatment for substance abuse have learning disabilities. Those are, when I first started talking to you, I thought that there was a much smaller application to just the learning differences aspect of your work than I now realize that there is. And how not only is it impact a lot more people, but the principles that you're sharing with us around learner universal design are applicable in so many areas of the work that we do. So thanks for sharing. I don't know if you have any thoughts about those, but those have really impacted me as you've shared them with us.
Yeah, they impact me every time I look at them. And you know, to be honest, I'm so at times hard on myself in this kind of work. I you know, the sciences, it's really hard to design great studies. There's a lot of studies that are out there that are less than great. So I'm really hard on myself of finding reliable data. And you know, and even live with the thought that some of this data may under or overestimate, you know, this part or that part. What I know for certain is that the effects of school struggle and learning disabilities is significant. And when I see something like what you just read, the presence of learning disabilities among clinically depressed and hospitalized children was 7 times higher than in the general population. Or when I think about, you know, what these facts really don't mention is who are in the prison population, meaning that this world of paying attention to the impacts on mental health of school struggles and from learning differences and learning disabilities is also under the purview or under the umbrella of diversity training. Because you can't talk about marginalized kids and kids who are ostracized or who are misunderstood and not being seen. You can't talk about all of these things without thinking about the ones that sometimes escape from the terrible consequences that we've started to talk about are sometimes or even often the kids who come from families of means, you know, who have the money to pay for expensive treatments, you know, or that it's not completely dissimilar from looking at issues of racial marginalization or gender marginalizations, that our job is not just to tolerate differences, or even just to celebrate the differences. The real work is digging into the dark shadow side of all of these reasons for being marginalized, all of these reasons for people suffering from trauma. You know, to dig deep and really come to grips with, oftentimes the trauma comes not from the culture or the disability, but from our response to it. That's kind of a hard truth to grapple with.
So with you, DL, with that in mind, can you give any examples of ways that people, that parents, that teachers, that therapists can engage or motivate children?
You know, I've studied the science. Thanks for the question. I've studied the sciences of motivation for a long time. Intrinsic rewards, extrinsic rewards, all good stuff. And I've worked with kids, gifted kids, kids with learning differences, and the combination of the two. I've worked with them for a long time and have developed a lot of strategies around motivation. But when I put it all together, the most important thing I can really think of that's been the most effective in my practice is that you help kids be seen. You act in a way where they feel seen. And in the area of learning differences, for example, for me, that means that I don't shy away from the conversations that try to give kids a practical, down-to-earth understanding of their learning profile. You know, and that means really digging in with them, kid-appropriate levels of unpackaging their psychoeducational evaluations. Because what that leads to is, you know, is, let's face it, the messages that kids with attention problems and ADHD, the message that they get is often that they're lazy, they're unorganized, things like that. Mm-hmm. But when they start to see that, well, you know, not as an excuse, but there's something that I need to understand here that my working memory is kind of in the crapper, even though my ability to deal with concepts is really high. And so that you begin to open up the door to understanding that the lack of follow through in goals may have a lot to do with working memory. But then there are things that you can do, that the kid can do to, you know, ameliorate or lessen those things, because they're not being character assassinated. They're not being seen as lazy and unmotivated. Kid with a reading difficulty, when they start to understand that, oh, I have a little weakness in processing speech sounds, and that's why it's hard for me to spell, not because I'm too lazy to study my spelling words. Those are ways that help kids be seen. And it's never a way out of being accountable. In fact, it leads to more accountability. So to sum it all up, the most effective way to motivate someone, in my experience, is that they're seen. And in this case, it means that their strengths as well as their weaknesses are seen in ways that are not shaming.
So maybe you can share with us an idea about what it looks like when a child has experienced educational or academic trauma, and then how that shows up for them therapeutically, clinically in their life.
You know, when I think about and when science looks at the most common areas of struggle that often can lead to wounding, diminishment of self, and trauma, it has to do with school struggle. And the most common form of school struggle are either diagnosable learning disabilities or a real misalignment of how kids are taught, a misalignment with their learning profile. When you hide and when you're filled with shame, you know, let's drill down a little bit further into, you know, learning differences. So you have someone that's not super fast with reading, but great with ideas, feels insight and understands big ideas, but struggles with the code of language to read and spell quickly and efficiently. But that's those areas of deficit are where they're judged, and those are the things that, or misunderstood, and those are the things that lead to those isolations that we're speaking about. And it cascades in a way where, you know, as you've described in some of your work, the sense of self gets diminished. And so you're now into this habit of hiding self and diminishing self.
I think anyone who listens to our podcast will understand very clearly why we're working with you and why we value what you have to offer in these areas. So thank you. Before we close, then I want to ask one last question for parents. Parents, in the context of thinking about enrolling their child in a wilderness therapy program, what do you think the things they could be thinking about? What could they be thinking about in terms of their children with or without school struggles or learning differences?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's also a two-sided coin, like most things are with me. So you ask a question, you're going to get both sides. You know, one is, you know, I think we've all learned that sometimes the questions parents ask are not really what's bothering them, you know, and that they need to have help and guidance to uncover the feelings of anxiety and fear about their kids that may lie underneath the question of college acceptance rates, you know, from an independent school. And we need to do a better job of supporting parents in their questions while at the same time looking beneath the questions, so that we turn parents into allies rather than anything else. But that said, change comes slowly to organizations and institutions, and the field of wilderness therapy needs to be prodded. And in part prodded internally, but also prodded by questions parents can ask. And so one of them, you know, simply is to ask a question of how does your program adjust the standard curriculum for struggling readers or struggling writers? You know, and to be able to answer that you have alternative ways is powerful to ask questions about journaling. Or, you know, I think a really big one that's really on target for wilderness treatment and for treatment centers in the aftercare world is to think about for a parent to ask for help for a wilderness therapy engagement in the question of untangling how to understand that if a child's trauma is school-based, at least in part, not only what does the wilderness therapy program do to tease this out as part of the clinical process, or how much does addressing school aversion in a wilderness setting transfer back to, you know, conventional classrooms, but to really, you know, further than that is to recognize that sometimes troubled teenagers use their learning disability diagnosis as an excuse or a crutch for bad behavior. Other times they're in complete denial about it. And so I think parents should rightly ask, how does your program help him or her find that right balance between accountability and denial?
Right.
Those are some of the important questions I would have. I would also ask, you know, this may be a little bit self-serving, but I would ask, what kind of training do clinicians get on thinking and cognition?
Well, thank you, Sanford. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining me on this today. And I think I've already seen, and you've shared one example, I've already seen a change in our culture. I look forward to the rehaul of our program as we continue to evolve and to make sure that we're casting the widest net. I think it makes a difference for the child in the field. I think it makes a difference for the families. It makes a difference for us as staff and clinicians. So I just want to thank you. And maybe more importantly and above and beyond that, I want to thank you for what it's like to have been your friend for many years, because the heart that you bring, I've always felt with you, whenever I'm with you, that I always feel like I get seen, and I always feel like I do my best learning when I'm in your presence. Somebody told me once that a great teacher is one where not necessarily they know the most, but where you learn the most in their presence. And I can say that's true for me at many levels. So I thank you professionally, and I thank you personally for what you've contributed to my life. And thanks for coming on board, and thanks for being on our podcast.
Well, powerful, powerful appreciation. And thanks for that. I do what I can. And I would sum up by saying thank you back for giving me the opportunity to do such work that's so important and fulfilling to me. It's absolutely a two-way street.